So we're just a few days away from Purim, whichever day that may be. And I'd like to divide our time this evening with regards to Purim, firstly to deal with a halachic, practical matter, that is to say, and then to move on to some more thematic discussions and insights with regards to Purim. Ki rabim heima, for there is indeed much to say. We begin by referring to a well-known chiddush with regards to Purim, and that is that not everyone has Purim on the same day. Although, generally, Purim is the 14th of Adar, that is for the unwalled cities, but for the walled cities, Purim is on the 15th of Adar. That means this year, Purim for the unwalled will be on the Thursday, and for the walled will be on the Friday. And the way the Mishnah presents it is that it's the qualification is a walled city from the time of Yoshua ben Nun. How did Yoshua ben Nun get into the picture here? Well, the Gemara learns it from Psukim in a somewhat more formal halachic way. But the Yerushalmi, and perhaps appropriate for the Yerushalmi, says that it's in order to give a cover to Yerushalayim. For one would think that the pertinent time would be if it's walled at the time of Achashverosh, when Shushan was walled, and we take our cue from the time of Achashverosh. The problem is, says the Yerushalmi, at that time, Jerusalem itself lay in ruins. And therefore, it would be an ongoing indignity that Yerushalayim would be like everyone else. Unwalled, it would be a constant reminder of the ruin that Yerushalayim was in at that time, and therefore, it's pulled back to the time of Yoshua ben Nun, when Yerushalayim had a wall around it, and that's when every city needs to take its cue from Yerushalayim. Ironically, we're not aware that Shushan itself had a wall at the time of Yoshua ben Nun, but of course, it gets a pass because the miracle happened in Shushan. That's what the Yerushalmi says. And so, whereas Eretz Yisrael, generally, and Yerushalayim specifically, are not really the focus of the Purim story. It's really focused elsewhere. Nonetheless, they are not to be forgotten. And indeed, there is a constant reminder of Yerushalayim in the fact that the timing is that of Yehoshua ben Nun. There is a further chiddush with regards to the 15th, the walled cities, which the Gemara states in Maseches Megillah and Daf Beis Amud Beis, right at the beginning, and that is, not only do the walled cities read on the 15th, but also any place which is close to a walled city, nearby, Samoch Lekrach, what is called, also reads on the 15th. How near is near? Well, the Gemara says, it is the distance of a mil. A mil is 2,000 amos, and assuming we take the standard measurement of an amma, it's just 2,000 amos is just under 1 kilometer. So any place that's within a kilometer of the walled city will also read on the 15th. Where does this come from? Well, the Gemara explains that it also comes from the Megillah, the idea of close to a walled city. For the Gemara quotes the Pasuk, and it's if you're familiar with the flow of the Megillah, it comes up quite a few times as it refers to the various places. The Pasuk uses the expression Medina u'Medina, ir va'ir. That's the source. The question, of course, is how do those words, Medina u'Medina, va'ir va'ir, how do they form the source of this idea that close to the walled city reads like the walled city? Well, interestingly, there's two approaches in the earlier Mefarshim. Rashi explains that Medina u'Medina is paralleled by ir va'ir, as if to say there's different types of Medinas, some walled, some unwalled, and there's different types of ears. If you're an ear close to a arib, if you're close to a Medina that's walled, then the ear becomes like the Medina. Samoch Lekrach, close to a walled city, has the status of the din of a walled city. Other Rishonim seem to derive this message just from the two words Medina u'Medina. Seemingly, it's from the Vav. That's the understanding, apparently, of the Rashba and the Ritva. Medina Umadina, as if to say, not only the Medina, which is presumably walled, Umadina, in addition, and, meaning it comes to include a broader area, that which is a samach to the walled city. So that's the source in Megillah, that is to say, Megillas Esther, however we understand it from the words Medina or Medina, and possibly also Ir va'ir. And should we ask, why Maru al-Kacha? Why would it be that a place that's close to the walled city reads like the walled city? That's not a standard, one could say. And here again, we have two classic reasons in the Mefarshim, one from the Rishonim and one from the Acharonim. The Rashba explains that really the benefit of a wall is that in times of trouble or danger, one can take refuge within the walls. Well, in times like that, those that avail themselves of the walls are not just those who live constantly in the city, but anyone who's close enough, and presumably can run fast enough, will also take refuge within the city. And therefore, in terms of the protection factor, we would say that people who are of the walled cities are not only those that live there, but those who are close enough to take advantage of it, if need be. We could say that those that are samach to the walled city, they are walled friendly. They are non-practicing walled city people. So this is the approach of the Rashba. So there is this zone around the wall where people also use the wall, and therefore they're in. They're part of their din is the same. Quite a different interpretation is to be found in one of the earlier Acharonim, the Turei Even. The Turei Even is the great Reb Aryeh Leib of Metz, the Shagas Aryeh, and in his commentary on Maseches Megillah Turei Even, he explains that what's the value here, or the idea here, is promoting achdus and not having too much confusion or disparity amongst the different people. And he explains that there will generally, I mean, let's say the walled city is the center, there will generally be to and froing to a certain degree with the areas that are outside. So anyone who lives within a mil of the wall, there's constantly people from the walled city to that degree outside, and people from outside inside, and therefore it was ascertained or understood that if as soon as you step outside the wall, it's a different day of Purim, there will be too many people who will be surrounded by others having Purim on a different day, and you're having Purim, and for the person next to you, it was either yesterday or tomorrow, and that would lead, at the least, to disparity, and perhaps even worse, to confusion. One shouldn't have Purim when the person to the right and to the left, for him it's just a normal day. And therefore, in a sense, again, this buffer zone of traffic, where there is to-ing and fro-ing, between the wall and that zone, the whole thing was thus unified, and everyone reads on the 15th. So these are very interesting reasons, the two classic reasons given, as to why it would be, why it is, that those that are close to the walled city read like the walled city. And what's very interesting to consider as we begin to develop the discussion is whether these reasons, shall we say, accompany the halacha, and perhaps things could change based on these reasons. And a classic example of this discussion finds expression in a question that the poskim deal with, namely, what if there would be a situation where there aren't really people, for whatever reason, having Purim on the 15th in the walled city? All there are people who are wondering when they should have Purim, and they're close to the walled city. Would we say that they still read on the 15th, like there would be read in the walled city if people would do that? Or do we say that perhaps they read on the 14th? And here, if we watch closely, we'll note that one could say that perhaps it depends on the reason why those close to the walled city read like the walled city. After all, if we posit, like the Rashba, that they really are considered to be part of the walled city, they avail themselves of the walls, they're close enough in times of danger, they'll find refuge within the walls, which means that their relationship to the walls is direct. It's personal. It's not a function of being like anyone who is in the city. They are considered to be in the city, in which case they would read on the 15th, even though there's no one actually in the city reading on the 15th. By contrast, if we would say that it's the value here is that the practices should be unified and homogenous, that you don't want different people reading on different days, you don't want to be having Purim on the 14th when the person who's next to you has Purim on the 15th, well, there is no one in the walled city having Purim on the 15th. So you don't have anyone to worry about. And on a practical level, one could perhaps suggest that those near the walled cities, if they're the only people in question, should default back to reading on the 14th. Well, that is a theoretical difference between the reasons. But of course, the critical question is, are these reasons ongoing reasons that are assessed constantly and shape the halacha given the various situations? Or could it be rather that these are reasons for the background? These set the territories, they set the areas, they set the definitions. But once it's set, that's it. And to say, well, now there's no one in the walled city, so perhaps it could change, that doesn't necessarily happen at all. And indeed, it's a matter of a historical note, tragic, of course. This question was halacha lemaisa for almost 20 years. Between 1948 and 1967, there were no Jews in the Old City. But there were many neighborhoods that were close to the Old City. They are samach lekrach, but there's no one in the krach. And the question was, when should they read? The consensus among the poskim, Reb Shlomo Zalman and others, Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank, is that they continued to read on the 15th. It was an amazing situation whereby there was no one in the city reading on the 15th, but everyone close to the city. They're still close, and they were the ones reading on the 15th. Interestingly, it's fair to say that none of the reasons applied on a practical level. Not only was there not the issue of different minhagim because no one was reading, I think, circumstances being what they were, we wouldn't say that those that were close to the wall would find refuge inside the city in times of trouble. For two reasons. Number one, they probably wouldn't be let in. Number two, trouble was inside the walls. Because Jordan was there. I mean, they are troubles, so that hardly represents a safe response in case things got a little bit difficult. So it's seemingly none of the reasons applied on a practical level, but the understanding is that those were the reasons behind the original takana. But once it's set, that's how it remains. Whoever's close to the wall reads like the walled city, even if there's no one in the walled city reading like that. Now, understandably, most of the halacha lemaisa questions about samach lekrach will center around the new neighborhoods in Yerushalayim. And what's interesting about this question, although it seems to be a classic case of near the walled city, the point is that New Jerusalem is many times the size of Old Jerusalem, and the question is, how should each neighborhood conduct itself? Here, if we return to the reasons, we may see that there could be a difference. And by that we mean, the Rashba has told us that the reason why those that are near the city read like the walled city is because they would take refuge within the walls up to a mill. But what happens if New Jerusalem is many mills distant? I mean, it covers a much greater area, and one could posit that not all of them would be able to find their way inside the walls. It couldn't hold all of them, not naturally. What would we say? Is it possible, and this is quite a striking idea, but is it possible that we would actually divide the city? As if to say, whoever is within 2,000 amos of the old city, well, that's the original takana. New Jerusalem happens to extend a good deal beyond that. Okay, so let it extend beyond that. Beyond 2,000 amos is reads like everybody else. And that is taking a very straight following of the understanding of the Rashba. If you're within 2,000 amos, you the walls. Beyond that, not even if it's in the middle, circumference could actually cut a neighborhood in half. That's quite a thing to suggest, and we'll see if anyone did suggest it. However, if we refer to the other example, the other reason, namely, of the Turei Even, that it's about preserving unity amongst the Minhagim. You shouldn't have different people having Purim right next to each other on different days. Well, actually, reason would then say that this should spread to all of that neighborhood, because on the contrary, if you're worried or concerned about different Minhagim between two different places just because there's traffic between them, certainly you don't want to end up in a situation where there's different Minhagim within the same place itself, which means that if within 2,000 Amos they're reading like the walled city, then certainly everywhere else in that neighborhood at the very least should also be reading on the 15th, so there shouldn't be different Minhagim within that very neighborhood. Well, thus far, the reasons and the theories. How does it turn out, Lamaisa? So we must mention, because it cannot go unmentioned, the very striking opinion of the author of Luach Eretz Yisrael. Every shul has a Luach Eretz Yisrael. And you kind of get the feeling that it wrote itself, which it didn't. Someone put it together. And that someone was a very special person. His name was Rabbi Chiel Michal Tikuchinsky. And he had many views on many different things. He was an expert, of course, in all of these calculations. And every shul in Eretz Yisrael basically goes by his Luach. And his opinion was that the areas that read on the 15th, like the Old City, is any place that is within a 2,000 Amos area around the Old City. That's it. If you're within 2,000 Amos, it's the 15th. If you live beyond 2,000 Amos, it's the 14th. And he clearly is taking his reasoning from the Rashba, that it's about those that are closer. And no, everyone's closer, so it really, that's the dividing line. And it could be, I mean, but just taking it to its practical conclusions, it could be that a neighborhood could be split in half. It could be that two houses are next to each other, if you're only exact with your calculations, and one is on the 15th and one is on the 14th. It could be. Moreover, without getting into all of the further discussions, as far as Rav Tikuchinsky is concerned, once you need to discover 2,000 Amos connected to the wall, the question then becomes, which wall? When we think of the Old City, and we think of the wall of the Old City, we think of the wall that we see, but that wall is a much later wall. But if we're looking at the original shape of Yerushalayim, it really will go after the earlier wall, and this begins a whole practical discussion as to what are the borders of the original Yerushalayim, because that's really where you need to measure from, and of course, needless to say, he has a chapter on that as well. In the Luach, he proceeds to identify all of the landmarks that will represent the cutoff point for 2,000 Amos. And what's fascinating is, he's very, very specific, but not only does no one paskin like him, those landmarks don't exist anymore. I mean, he'll talk about the post office and the train station, and people nowadays, they don't know what a post office is, or a train station. So, and they're not there anyway, and everything's moved. So, but nonetheless, he wrote the Luach. He wrote the Luach, so Luach has his opinion on it. And therefore, if you open Luach Eretz Yisrael, you will always see every year a nice few pages on the borders of 2,000 Amos within the city of Yerushalayim. So that's Rabbi Chiel Michal Tukuchinsky, but his opinion apparently was not followed by anyone else, and certainly no one nowadays. According to most poskim, what does it look like in terms of New Jerusalem? So we should know that there's actually a double-barreled aspect to their opinion. Not only are they not prepared to slice a neighborhood in half, in other words, as if one neighborhood is reads on the 15th, the whole neighborhood reads on the 15th, even if it's beyond the 2,000 Amos, it's more than that. Namely, they're not inclined to look at New Jerusalem as close to the Old City. And the reason why is because since the housing of New Jerusalem begins so close to the Old City, it's actually looked upon as an expansion of the city. So it's not even considered to be nearby. It's it. Jerusalem has grown. Which means anyone who is in this new city, they're reading not because they're close to a place that reads on the 15th. They're in a place that reads on the 15th. Jerusalem is expanded. But the question now becomes, well, you know, how do you know what the borders of Jerusalem are? I mean, where do you draw the line? We're now saying that if you want to know where Jerusalem is, it's not just the old city, even new. But until when? At Heichan Advarim Amurim? What's the metric for knowing whether you're still part of Jerusalem or not? Well, the Poskim tell us we have an established way of ascertaining whether a neighborhood is part of a city. It's not in Hilchos Megillah, interestingly, it's in Hilchos Shabbos. For as we know, there exists a concept in Hilchos Shabbos called Tchumim. Tchumim means that one, in principle, is not allowed to walk more than 2,000 amos on Shabbos. Most people I know are not inclined to do even half of that, but in principle, that's the halacha, there's an iser, derabanan, of a Tchum Shabbos. However, I mean, many people will walk freely for a good amount. I mean, how is that okay? So the Gemara tells us that within the city, that's all called like four amos. That's the count hasn't started yet. You need to leave the city limits, and then your 2,000 amos begin. So anyone walking within the city itself could be many thousands of amos, and that's still considered to be not having really moved. You have to leave the city. And that is why it is very much of the essence to know when are you still in the city. And the Gemara introduces a concept, in Erevin, of course, introduces a concept which is called Ibur Ha'ir. Ibur Ha'ir is the extension of the city, which is yet still part of the city. How close does the next house need to be that will still say this is the outer part of the city, as opposed to a house which is near the city? Well, the answer is, well, for a single house, it's 70 amos. If it's a group of houses, then each one gets their 70 buffer zone. So as long as it's within 140 amos, which is about 70 meters, it's still considered to be part of the city. Therefore, taking their cue from this idea, if you wish to know how far Jerusalem extends, you'll always be asking that question. Are the outer houses, or is there a continuum with less than a break at any point of 140 amos, 70 meters? If there is, it's still Jerusalem. If not, it's a neighborhood next to Jerusalem, but that's already not Jerusalem anymore. Which means that, in a sense, we've almost seemed to have left the halachas of Megillah behind. And our focus is entirely now in the halachas of Erevin. As we're defining, it's still part of the city, still part of the city. And things change indeed, because a lot of neighborhoods, they begin perhaps distant somewhat from Jerusalem, and then they become closer. They become closer because the territory, the area in between, gets built up. But we should know further. I mean, here we are saying, you know, always look, is there 70 meters between this and the next house, the next house, the next house? There is one further fascinating point. We shouldn't forget, the Gemara tells us that if you're within a mil of a place that reads, or of a city that reads for it on the 15th, you also read on the 15th. That's a kilometer. The question is, where do we reckon the mil from? And here, there's a classic dispute between the Chazon Ish and the Toras Chesed. The Chazon Ish is of the opinion that the mil, the 2,000 amos, will only ever be measured from the wall. Now, if you've actually gone way past that because you're in the new city, so then you leave the 2,000 amos behind, and it's not relevant. You'll only ever be asking, is it within 70 meters, 140 amos? That's the only relevant question at that stage. Well, the Toras Chesed, the great Rav Shneur Zalman of Lublin, who settled in the end of his days in Yerushalayim, says no. A stunning chiddush, and that is, if indeed the city has expanded, so then you get a mil from the outer limits of the new city, because the mil is from the outer perimeter of the city. If the perimeter is the walls, you get a mil from the walls. But if we're saying that the new city has expanded now, so then you'll get 1 kilometer distance from the outer limits of the city is called somach le'ir. And they will also read by the 15th. And there were many neighborhoods that went through this teething stage, one could say, where they were more than 70 meters away from the outer limits, but they were within a kilometer, and they fell within this discussion, this dispute between the Chazon Ish and the Toras Chesed. And then, in a sense, it's a wave that washes over them because they begin in that zone, but then, Baruch Hashem, houses get built up, and then they find themselves safely within. There's many neighborhoods like that. In fact, most of the neighborhoods, Beit Vegan and Givat Shaul and Harnof and all of them, they began that way, and they entered into that zone. More than 140 amos, less than a mil, and then in the course of time, they became less than 140 amos and came near. Two further fascinating svaras from Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach in this matter. Firstly, and it's based on Rishonim, it's based on Ritva, Reb Shlomo Zalman says something which sounds quite startling. And that is that when it comes to Purim, the definition of whether you're part of the city is not just about distance. It's whether you share the same municipality. That is taken from the Ritva. The Ritva says that any area, in his words, mishtatfim bi'inyanei ha'ir, that means that you'll be taking services from them and paying taxes to them, and that's your reference point, is that city. Even if you are further away, you will still be considered part of that city for Megillah. That's quite a chiddush. And based this, the Rav Shlomo Zalman, although there was a major discussion about this, the neighborhoods of Ramot, and this is back in the day where there was only just a couple of them, but nonetheless, even the first one was quite far away. I don't know if it was called Ramot for that reason, but it was quite far away. And some people said, it's too far, and therefore it should read on the 14th, maybe both days, but really the preponderance was on the 14th. But Rav Shlomo Zalman said, no, Ramot shares the same municipality as Yerushalayim, therefore it's part of Yerushalayim, they should read on the 15th. This actually position was disputed by his illustrious mechutan, Rav Eliashiv Zatzal, one of their many disputes. And Rav Shlomo Zalman held it was the 15th, Rav Eliashiv held it should be on the 14th. And it's a matter of interest that this came to a fore in a very interesting context. The Rav of Ramot, Rav Shlomo Cohen, I think was his name, he wrote a sefer, and of course, Kedarkom Shel Mechavri Sfarim, so he brought his sefer to the Gedolei Torah for Haskamah, for an approbation. And he came to Rav Eliashiv and to Rav Shlomo Zalman. And they both wrote him, of course, glowing Haskamah, and Rav Eliashiv said, Lichvot HaRav Cohen, Rav Deshkunat Ramot, I've read your sefer, and it's etc. and so forth. Rav Shlomo Zalman, he gave his haskama and he says, L'chvod Rav Cohen, Rav Dishkunat Ramot, Ir HaKodesh, Yerushalayim, I read your sefer, etc. And really part of that was an expression of their differing views as to whether it was part of Yerushalayim. The second svara, and here actually Rav Eliashiv is in full agreement with Rav Shlomo Zalman, that is, what if there's an Eruv around these areas? It could be that there's more than a kilometer that separates this neighborhood from the most, the nearest neighborhood. But if there is an Eruv that surrounds them all, and Rav Shlomo Zalman is of the opinion that an Eruv works, because an Eruv essentially makes it like all one domain. It's all like one house. So if it's one house, it can't be a separate city. You can't be in the same house and be in a different city. And therefore, certainly, if it works to make it like one domain, it should certainly make it like one city. And based on the Eruv, the Jerusalem Eruv, he was inclined also to include all of those neighborhoods. Except, some people asked Rav Shlomo Zalman, because you get asked everything, what if you don't rely on the Eruv? It wouldn't be an Eruv if some people didn't rely on it. So what then? And Rav Shlomo Zalman said, it doesn't matter, because the Eruv itself, which is really based on what's called Tzuras HaPerach, which is a series of doorways, that's the wire that goes over those beams. In principle, it's acceptable. There is also an acceptable stringency not to rely on it. However, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, that stringency is a function of the severity of Hilchos Shabbos. For Shabbos reasons, people elect not to rely on the Eruv. However, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, Purim is not Shabbos. And therefore, in principle, the Eruv works, and you have no reason not to rely on it, and every reason yes to rely on it. So you can have an interesting situation where a person doesn't use the Eruv every week, but he only uses it once a year, on a weekday. And that's to define himself as part of Jerusalem for Megillah. The second question, which is actually a very interesting Shaila, is what if the Eruv should break during Purim, essentially? If the only thing that connects them with the rest of the city is this Eruv, so their status, one could say, is literally hanging by a wire, and if it should snap in the middle of Purim, and the Eruv can snap. So then do they revert back into non-Purim? And that was their worry. And it is a legitimate worry for Shabbos, but Rav Shlomo Zalman said that as long as the Eruv will be repaired, the status of all of those neighborhoods is ultimately part of the same city. It would not be affected if the Eruv were to break. So those are the two very interesting additional svaras of Rav Shlomo Zalman. Mishtatfim be'inyani ha'ir, based on the Ritva, a shared municipality, and the Eruv itself. It's worthwhile noting, in conclusion, that we've stated that the idea of being close to a city, which changes your status, is only, we said, for Jerusalem. Why? Because Jerusalem is the only city that we know that's walled from the time of Yeshua ben Nun. Now, there are other cities that are in doubt in this matter. That is to say, we're not sure whether they were walled from the time of Yeshua ben Nun, or perhaps we're not sure whether this is exactly the location of that city, which could also be. So what about the places that are close to them? Those cities that are in doubt read both days. A place that's close to them, within a kilometer, would it also read both days in terms of summer? But the one who seems to hold sway here is the Chida in the Sefer Birkei Yosef, and he states that the idea of being close will only affect a place that's close to a definitely walled city that reads definitely on the 15th. If it's maybe 14th or 15th, it will not affect Samach, which has major implications. Because otherwise, as the Poskim point out, a place like Tel Aviv would probably need to read on both days. Because Tel Aviv is essentially connected to Yafo, and Yafo reads on both days. It was originally, that's how it grew, because it was a satellite of Yafo, Yafo Tel Aviv, which then became Tel Aviv with Yafo in brackets. But Yafo is one of those questionable cities, nonetheless, that those 2 days do not extend to places that are nearby, and Tel Aviv reads on the 14th. And so it turns out that anyone living in New Jerusalem, anyone who has that privilege, is literally living in a riveting sugya on Purim, and that's part of the Purim celebrations, is to understand exactly why we read on the day that we do. Okay, so thus far, the halachas, which are really fascinating. And from there, let us move to discuss some other matters of Purim. It's very interesting to note that Purim, as the Megillah describes it, Megillas Esther, has a different description the first time round than the second. It's described in Perek Tes of the Megillah. And the first time it's presented, the word Yom Tov is used. Al Kain, Hayudim, etc. They celebrate La So Yemei, Mishte, Simcha, V'Yom Tov, U'Mishloach Manos, Ishlari Ehu. A few psukim later, it's re-presented, and the word Yom Tov is not there. But rather, they make them days Yemei, Mishte, V'Simcha, Mishloach Manos, Ishlari Ehu, U'Matonis Le'Evyonim. What happened to the Yom Tov? And the Gemara in Megillah explains that there was a proposal, there was an enactment of sorts, that it should be mamish like a Yom Tov. That's a Yom Tov Drabanan, but we're aware of Yom Tov's Drabanan. Second day Yom Tov is Drabanan. That Purim should be a Yom Tov, with no malacha and everything that goes with it. And parenthetically, that's why, as Reb Shlomo HaKohen of Vilna, in the Tshuvas Binyan Shlomo, points out, in the first presentation, there's no mention of Matanis Levyonim. Own Mishloach Manos, because if it's really Yom Tov, money's mukta. But the Gemara says they didn't accept it. They didn't accept it. Lo kiblu was not accepted as a Yom Tov. And so it kind of got phased out rather quickly, it seems. And therefore the day is not a Yom Tov, but it's lots of other things, but it's not Yom Tov. So I found this Gemara to be somewhat troubling, certainly thought-provoking, and the reason why is because Purim for us is known as a day of Kabbalah Satorah. As we know, and the background is known to this, that there was something about the Kabbalah Satorah that we, in a sense, needed to be forced to receive the Torah. The Pasuk states in Parshas Yisro, Perikutez, Vayisiyatsu betachte Sahar, they stood literally at the underneath the mountain. Practically, it means, pshat, it means at the bottom of the mountain, but the drash is underneath the mountain. And the Gemara in Shabbos and Daf Peches tells us that Melamed, well-known words of the Gemara, Shekof Aleim HaKadosh Baruch Hu Sahar Kigigis, that the mountain was suspended over them, and they were told that they have to receive the Torah. Okay. Now, the Gemara reacts to this. And the Gemara says, well, if you're forced to receive the Torah, then that would seem to empty out the validity of that agreement, because you had no choice. That idea is called Moda'a. Moda'a is a disclaimer. It's a voiding of the validity of an agreement, because you had no choice in the matter. And that's what the Gemara charges. Mikan Moda'a Rabba La'araisa. It seems like a disclaimer for the Torah. And therefore the terms and conditions shouldn't be binding. Well, Rava's response to that is Hadar ki blua bimei Achashverosh. Subsequently, we receive the Torah in the days of Achashverosh. And the source for that in the Megillah are the words Kimu v'kiblu. Kimu v'kiblu hayuhudin. Now, in context, that sounds like it's a reference to Purim itself. Kimu v'kiblu. The only thing is, those two terms are backwards, because a kimu means to uphold, kiblu means to accept. You can't uphold something before you've accepted it. And therefore, on a pshat level, it should have said kiblu v'kimu. They accepted and upheld. But what is kimu v'kiblu? And therefore, says Rava, kimu mashe kiblu kvar. They upheld that which they had already received. Now, there's a great deal to discuss about that Gemara, because b'chozot, 1,000 years were between the original acceptance and the subsequent acceptance, but nonetheless. And therefore, a very major theme within Purim is finally receiving the Torah. There's something not fully received, apparently, at the time of Matan Torah, now fully received. And therefore, how striking it is that Dafka, at a time of Kabbalah Satorah, and then Megillah comes in, and Mordechai, I think it's Mordechai and his Beis Din, they said, and it should be a Yom Tov, v'lo kiblua. They didn't accept it. Of all the times not to accept something, and this is like the historical accepting of the Torah, one would have think that they'd accept everything. And Mordechai says, and it should be a Yom Tov, and the Jewish people say, no, we don't accept that. That doesn't sound in line with the Kabbalah Satorah of Purim. It's very interesting. It's a bit of an anomaly within the Ruach of that time. Well, we should know, and we do know, that Tosfos have a famous question with regard to being forced to receive the Torah. Because the linear reading sounds like we didn't really want to receive the Torah, but we were forced to receive the Torah, but it doesn't really count. But then in the end, we did receive it in the days of Achashverosh. But Tosfos says, well, if you look at the Pasuk, it states that when we were asked if we were going to receive the Torah, we said, Naaseh v'nishma. And Naaseh v'nishma means yes. It was a stellar acceptance. I mean, that's our finest hour, is Naaseh v'nishma. So this becomes very unusual now. Because we have to reckon with the fact that they were forced to receive the Torah, which is itself a challenging idea, but all the more so when we consider that we'd already accepted it. So the progression is, do we wish to receive the Torah? Yes. And then we're forced to receive the Torah. And we'd said yes. That's Tosis's question. It's also known that this question, it's famous as Tosis's question, but it preceded Tosis. By many hundreds of years, because this question is actually raised in the Medrash Tanchuma, in Parshas Noach. And I mean, everyone talks about this and everyone has their approach to it, but the Tanhuma came first. And the Medrash Tanhuma says that the reason why we accepted the Torah but still had to be forced to receive the Torah is because what we were forced to receive was a part that we didn't accept yet. Namely, the Torah has two parts to it, Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, Torah Shebalpeh, oral Torah. And Na'aseh V'Nishma says the Tanhuma was for the written Torah. But the oral Torah, we weren't quite sure, and that's why Kaf Aleihem Sahar Kegigis was for Torah Shebal Peh. So there's no contradiction between our acceptance and being forced to receive, because they're really two separate domains. We accepted willingly Torah Shebichtav. Torah Shebal Peh needed a bit of further elements to it. Interestingly, one could say that the words of the Medrash Tanhuma are alluded to in the Torah itself. And the reason why is because the Vilna Gaon has a very interesting discussion with regards to two terms that are they're often used either interchangeably or together with each other, and they are Amira and Dibur. Amira is, well, to translate them, they sound almost the same, almost synonymous, speaking, saying. What's the difference in connotation? There's a number of differences between them. But the Vilna Gaon states that the difference between them is that Dibur tends to refer to the domain of Torah Shebichtav. Amira relates to the domain of Torah Shebal Peh. And he explains many psukim based on this idea. Actually, I found a prior source to this, seemingly, in the words of Rabbeinu Bachya, in his commentary to Chumash Bayikra. For there he states that when Hashem generally says to Moshe, Daber al Bnei Yisrael, Va'amarta aleihem, what's the difference between what are you speaking to them and what are you saying to them? Rabbeinu Bachya says that Daber aleihem means generally, and Va'amarta aleihem, and then tell them the details. And then Rabbeinu Bachya says, well, the general idea is in the Pasuk, and all the details are in Torah Shebal Peh. So it turns out that that division of Dibur referring to the more general Torah Shebichtav, written Torah presentation, versus Amira, which is the more detailed Torah Shebal Peh presentation, that actually is rooted, I believe, in the words of Rabbeinu Bachya there. In any case, for our purposes, it's interesting to note that the Pasuk tells us, with regards to Kabbalah Satorah, that Moshe presents the Torah to the Jewish people, Vayan, and they say, Kol Asher Diber Hashem Na'aseh V'Nishma. Whatever Hashem spoke, Na'aseh V'Nishma. According to the Gaon, Dibur is Torah Shebichtav. That, I believe, is a source for the or allusion to what the Medrash Tanhuma is saying, that Na'aseh V'Nishma was about Kol Asher Diber Hashem. Kol Asher Amar Hashem, they weren't quite sure yet. Now, if that's true, then we need to move forward to Purim, because we shouldn't forget that whatever was missing from our volition and willing acceptance at the time of Matan Torah was filled in at the time of Purim. And putting the two together, therefore, it seems that what was missing at the time of Matan Torah was accepting Torah Shebal Peh, which means when it says Kimu V'Kiblu, somehow it was a willing acceptance of Torah Shebal Peh specifically. Because Torah Shebichtav had already been accepted. What was missing in Torah Shebal Peh, that came in now. And the question is, how does one lead to the other? I mean, how are the two connected? Ma'inyin Torah Shebal Peh, Itzel Purim. And I came across just today a fascinating discussion of this point in the writings of Rabbi Kamenetsky. It happens to be at the end of Parshas Kisavo, so I already missed it, except I was directed to it, and there it is, in the end of Parshas Kisavo, he starts to talk about Purim. And he explains that when the Medrash says that we had an easier time accepting Torah Shebichtav and not such an easy time accepting Torah Shebal Peh, and we may ask, well, you know, what's the difference between that? Well, because you need to memorize more. I mean, is there different content? So Rabbi Yaakov explains that actually we had an easier time relating to the idea of Torah Shebichtav and a harder time relating to the idea of Torah Shebal Peh. And why is that? Well, the truth is, it's actually very understandable, says Rabbi Yaakov, Because the whole idea of Torah is divine will, divine instruction, divine commandments. In a sense, Torah Shebichtav doesn't really involve the individual in any capacity other than understanding it and receiving it. And that's in line with our notion of what Torah should be. Hashem tells you what to do, and you either understand it or you don't. I mean, you either understand what's behind it or you don't, but it comes from on high. Maybe you can't expect to understand it, and maybe it doesn't matter if you do or don't. Torah Shebaal Peh has a completely different dynamic, because a lot of it is really the Chachomim, Chachmei HaTorah, working it out, and darshaning, and propounding halachas based on how they understand what the Pasuk is saying. That notion is practically a paradox, if not impossible. Because who is man, really, to have this input in terms of formatting the halacha as he understands it, and darshaning, and propounding, and such like? And the truth of the matter is, says Rabbi Yaakov, our relationship with Hashem's word, with Hashem's law, is a product of our relationship with Hashem's relationship with us. That means that at the time of Matan Torah, our sole interaction with Hashem had been completely, in a sense, unnatural, otherworldly. What had he done for us? Miracles, which were fantastic, but also suvamosim. But the point is, in a sense, that only really serves to underscore the notion that Hashem's involvement in the world and his input into the world is otherworldly. So then, now, if that's true in terms of his guidance of the world, so then it, presumably that's how his instructions for the world come in, and we're okay with that. But then you have this other idea that there's so much for us to work out, and us working out something with our minds, Chachmei HaTorah, with their minds, to try and relate to God's mind, so to speak, it just seemed impossible. And nothing that we'd ever experienced gave us to understand that there was any point of connection or interface between, in a sense, the way people are and how they think and such like, and Hashem's involvement with that. And that is the major contribution and revolution, really, that came with the miracle of Purim. For as we know, Purim differs in nature from all other miracles. It wasn't supernatural in that way. It was a series of highly complex, orchestrated events. Each one by itself could happen anywhere, to anyone. Of course, you put it all together and it's clearly someone's guiding it. But it's a different order of miracle altogether. Very much in the natural. In fact, I came across a fascinating comment in the name of the Vilna Gaon. The Mishnah tells us in the beginning of Maseches Megillah that the Megillah originally could be read on one of 5 days, not only the 14th and the 15th, but also the 11th, 12th, and 13th. And that was for the benefit of the villagers who didn't make it into the city except for Monday and Thursday. They were given from the Megillah a special dispensation to bring their Megillah reading back to the preceding Monday and Thursday. That's when they're going to be in the city. They can't read in the village. No one knows how to read. They don't have a Megillah, etc. When they're in the city on the Monday or Thursday closest preceding, that's when they hear the Megillah. Which means it could be that they're in the city the day before Purim. If it's on Tuesday, they're there the day before. If it's on Wednesday, they're there 2 days before. If it's on Sunday, they're there 3 days before. The preceding Thursday is the 11th. And thus the Mishnah tells us in Maseches Megillah, that's how it opens, Perik Aleph, Mishnah Aleph, Megillah Nikreis, B'yud Aleph, Yud Beis, Yud Gimel, Yud Dalet, Tesvav. Lo pachot, v'lo yoter. Not earlier, not later. Says the Vilna Gaon. It's a real gem. The name of Hashem, and of course names are the way that Hashem relates to the world, so there is a name that relates to natural miracles and a name that relates to supernatural miracles. The name that relates to natural miracles is a name Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud. That's why now, currently, we're surrounded by nature. That's the only name that we will enunciate, vocalize. That's the name Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud. The master of the world guides the world. But there is another name that represents Hashem's input, supernatural. hence the name of Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, the one who gave all of existence, can reshape existence at any time. That's the name Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. That's why as a prelude to the supernatural miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim, Hashem said, Ushmi Hashem Yud-Kei Vav-Kei lo nodati lahem. Well, says the Vilna Gaon, Purim, as we know, was a natural miracle, and that's why the Megillah is read on the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th. What's so significant about those days? Says the Gaon, put them all together. If you add up 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15, you will come to a total of 65. That is the numerical value of the name Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud. That's Hashem as master of the world, because that's the type of miracle that Purim was. Those days, lo pachot v'lo yoter. Not less, not more. What's less than 11 is 10, and what's more than 15 is 16. And 10 and 16 is 26. That's the name Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. So the Mishnah is telling us that the way the miracle worked was 11 to 15, not less and not more. So this is the unique, it's a new type of miracle. This is the unique nature of the miracle of Purim, that it is a very natural thing. And says Rabbi Yaakov, the effect on the Jewish people was enormous, because this was the first time that they saw clearly Hashem guiding the world in a very natural way. They understood, with their elevated insight, they understood it's Hashem guiding the world, but he's guiding very normal types of events. That was the experience that they had in their own miracle. And says Rabbi Yaakov, everything changed at that point. See, once we see Hashem relating to us in a more, quote-unquote, natural way, in terms of the things that human beings do and the way that nature goes, and Hashem is also connected with that, as opposed to in contrast with the other miracles which were all supernatural, it opened the door for us to understand that perhaps, therefore, the Torah also is connected in that way. That as surely as an elevated mind can perceive God's guidance during the Purim story, well, an elevated Torah mind can perceive God's will within the Torah and begin to propound halachas based on Torah Shebaal Peh. It was an absolute breakthrough. So it was a breakthrough moment for Bnei Yisrael. And the result was they finally, fundamentally, related to the concept of Torah Shebaal Peh. Kimu v'kiblu. They understood that it was possible. They need to elevate their minds as much as possible. But if they do, there is that interface between Hashem's will and the ability of Chachmei HaTorah to understand it. Interestingly, alongside of this, we're saying that this was a very Torah Shebaal Peh type miracle. But the source is to be found in Torah Shebichtav. The downfall of Haman actually took place on the second day of Pesach, the 16th of Nisan. What's the yichus of the 16th of Nisan? The 16th of Nisan has a once a year event that happens on it, and that is the bringing of the Korban Omer. And indeed, it was during the 16th that Haman had to come and find Mordechai, he had to go and schlep him out, and put him on the horse and ride him through. That was between the two feasts, 15th and 16th. That was the day of the 16th. And so he finds him and he finds Mordechai's teaching. He's teaching his Talmidim. But what is he teaching them? In Yonah Diyoma, right? The halachas, they don't have a Beis HaMikdash, but Bezman Sheh Beis HaMikdash Kaim. He's teaching the halachas of Omer. And Haman has a moment where he sits in on the shear. And he's quite baffled by the whole thing. So he begins to ask them, what happens? What are you discussing? So it's the Korban Omer, you take the barley, and then the Kohen takes the Kmitzah, he takes just a handful. And Haman says, a handful of what? I mean, you know, that's just a handful. It's got to be very valuable. Is it gold, silver? Mordechai says, a handful of barley. And Haman, who already sees that he's on the decline, but he's locked in already, he says, and with great irony, the handful of barley that you're talking about in the end proved more significant and more influential than the 10,000 kikar kesef of silver that I paid to Ahasuerus, because you're winning and I'm losing. And it's very interesting that somehow the discussion that he met Mordechai in is the Korban HaOmer, Except the Maharal in the Sefer Or Chadash explains that really the Omer is about this idea. Even as the Jewish people come into Eretz Yisrael, and from a certain point of view, they naturalize more than their existence in the wilderness, where the food will, for a change, will come out of the ground. It's not going to drop out of the heavens. And therefore, there will be many natural forces in play. It's the agricultural cycle. It's the rainfall. It's the soil. It's the tending and the reaping and the sowing and all of that. To that end, the Torah says, the year begins, or the reaping of the harvest begins, with a korban omer. It begins with a korban. That korban is a statement. It's a statement of recognition that as much as we're ostensibly much more involved in natural forces, but nonetheless, it's a recognition of who guides those forces. And therefore, in a sense, the day of Haman's downfall is the day of the omer. Because Haman is looking to see the Jewish people as completely subject to natural forces, in which case his hand is upper. However, as long as the Jewish people reinforce the realization represented by the Omer, that as much as they're in much more natural surroundings, but at the end of the day it's Hashem who's guiding it, to the extent that they connect with that idea, subscribe to that idea, and invest in it, that's the extent to which Hashem responds accordingly. And Haman recognized this, and that's how there's no other way to account for his downfall. The Jewish people seemingly at the subject of forces of nature, but they're never subject to the forces of nature if they recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu as guiding all of those forces. And so it turns out that the breakthrough of Purim, the Chiddush of Purim, is Hashem's involvement, so to speak, in very normal things, in very natural things. And that's the Chiddush. The one of the sages of the Talmud, he introduced his shir in the Megillah with the pasuk, "Mi goy gadol asher Elohim krovim elav," which other nation has their deity close to them? Kashem Elokeinu bechol koreinu elav. Hashem is close to us whenever we call him. We may have been inclined to think that we were beyond reach or beyond salvage, perhaps. But Mordechai says we call out, Hashem will be there, right? Never far away, even though we're seemingly at the mercy of the forces of nature. Wherever we will be, that's the message of Purim. However far away, Hashem will be there for us if we call out to him. And therefore, I believe there's a great deal of meaning in the non-acceptance of Purim as a Yom Tov. Because in a sense, every Yom Tov is a day out of the ordinary. The day becomes more Shabbos-tic, more Yom Tov-tic, and we're stepping away from our involvement in the world. But in a sense, Purim is about us being in that world, and Hashem being close to us in that world. That's the point. That's the message of Purim. And therefore, on some level, the collective consciousness of the Jewish people, notwithstanding the fact that there was a national, incredible acceptance of Torah, but that very acceptance of Torah meant that today is not a Yom Tov. It's a normal day, so to speak, because what we're celebrating is our connection with Hashem on a normal day. Of course, Purim then you can make a great deal out of a normal day, but a Yom Tov, it isn't. It's Thursday. It's Friday. And on that you build, because that means Hashem is there for us on all the Thursdays and Fridays and Sundays and Mondays and Tuesdays. And the absence of Purim as a Yom Tov, therefore, I think has a very resounding message. It's the irony of celebrating a non-Yom Tov. That's really what Purim is, which is pretty much about as backwards as everything else in Purim is. But the message is most profound. And it's a message not only that was learnt by the Jewish people at that time, it's tikvasam bechol dor vador. The story of Purim is read every year because it's got a message for us every year. We are back in the forces of nature. We haven't really left, not really, since the time of Purim. It's the story of the Jewish people until the Geula, because every generation will find itself with its forces of nature. And there is the preponderance to say, the tendency to say, well, for the force of nature, well, we're helpless and hopeless and we're in trouble. And, you know, it's not like the good old days when everything was supernatural and we were connected with Hashem. And those were the good times. But in these times, the story of Purim, we're unlikely to feel more lost than the Jewish people did in that time. And Mordechai says, reach out and Hashem is there for you. And that's the success of Purim. And that's the message of Purim for each generation. And that's why it's an eternal salvation, because it can happen at any time. Netzach, v'tikvasim b'chol davador, and that's our hope in these days. Again, we're back again, dealing with Achashverosh essentially, and his cohorts, and we're at the there's many forces of nature in play. Not to forget the Korban HaOmer, the one who's guiding it, and that should be our hope. Then indeed, it will guide things towards the Geula Shelema b'Meheiru Yameinu.